Hey Bo, how's it
Norm,
going?
how are you?
I'm good. Long time no see.
I know, likewise. I'm gonna let people in, but I want to make you a co-host. So let me do that. Hey, there we are. All right, so we're going to give it a minute or two here to let
Sure.
people in. I love this background.
Oh yeah, it's better than just seeing like the kids' underwear on the couch behind me. So I try to make things a little more fantastical, keep things moving. It's about time to change it almost. I've had it for a few weeks for I just searched for like fantasy library.
That's super cool. I haven't seen them in so long. I feel like they must be in high school now.
The older one, Quentin, is he's 13, so he's gonna go into high school in the fall. But he's taller than us now. He's like 5'9" now, yeah. So yeah, things change really fast when those hormones start kicking in.
They sure do. My brother's twin boys are 15, so I know that age well. Hi,
Yeah.
everyone. I want to welcome everyone in. We were just chatting here in the background. So welcome, welcome. And I think people are still coming in. So we'll sort of, maybe we can get started and let people come in just as they do. So hello everyone, and hi Norm again. So often when I'm doing a master class or some other webinar event, we do like a tech version of loving kindness or metta through the Zoom. And maybe we could do that today in an abbreviated version. So whoever would like to, if you want to pop in the chat and say where you're logging in from, where in the world you are today, and just say hello to one another. And if you have an intention for the community or even for yourself that's sitting on the tip of your e-tongue, you could also feel free to offer that as well. And I won't read them out loud, but I think people have let us know that they really appreciate seeing where people are in the world and kind of feeling that sense of solidarity and being together so that it's really, so that we're kind of bringing community in right at the beginning and appreciating our globalness and being able to witness that in the chat. And alongside the video and audio for today, I will pop the chat up too so that you all can download that. All right, so welcome to this interactive webinar with Norman Farb. And the plan is for Norm and I to chat about his work and about his book and kind of put flesh on the bones of some of his, I think, key ideas that are, I think, digestible for us all and also really important and supportive to our lives. And then we'll open it up to everyone and to any questions you might have or reflections. And we allowed 75 minutes for this. If there are burning questions at the end, Norm, I don't know what your flex time is at the end. If things are sizzling, we could maybe allow a little more time. But you let us know kind of how you're feeling about that. So, we had a bunch of kind of introductory materials leading up to this, in which I introduced Norm. But to those things, to this kind of idea of this bio that we put out that kind of represents us, I wanted to say that Norm is not only a renowned neuroscientist and a contemplative practitioner, but he's also a dear colleague and friend. And in addition to that, Norm was generous enough to come to Boston during one of our 500-hour teacher trainings for a full weekend and teach to our cohort and then open it up to a wider community. And it was a really incredible part of teacher training to really be looking deeply into the science of awareness and And then how to apply that to our lives, which we'll do today too. And we might even have some of that teacher training cohort with us today. And if you are with us live, feel free to pop an extra greeting to Norm in the chat as well. I know that some of us have signed up for this, but I just don't know who will be here live. And you know, one reason why I've come out of a long period of book writing hibernation, I just want to say, Norm, that during the years after I signed my book contract, you envisioned a book, got a contract, wrote it, published it, and now it's been out in the world for a while. And I'm still on that first. I just handed in my first draft. So my process has been going slowly, and it's amazing to see how fast yours went. And also just the beauty of the final product. I have to confess that I think that modern technology has impacted my attention span along with other people. So rarely do I read a book all the way through. It usually at some point I kind of stop. And not only did I read this all the way through once, but also a second time. And so I'm going to share some of my kind of most exciting discoveries from within the book and ask you, Norm, to kind of expand on them. And there's also kind of another reason that I really wanted to begin my coming back into the world with Norm. And I think, Norm, it's because you have a quality that's very rare, at least in my experience, which is that you really apply the work that you do in science and contemplative practice to daily life as a colleague, a friend, a parent. And one of the things I've appreciated about you, I don't know if I've actually ever told you this, but you actively work, I think, to help not just yourself, but the people around you to learn to be with sensations and also with the very human reactions we have to situations in a genuine way, but then also not to stew in them indefinitely. And I think that's a really incredible quality because often we want our friends and the people that we have in our lives to mirror our reactions. And that is one kind of theme from the book and something I've really appreciated with you, Norm, is that you don't stew indefinitely with somebody in that space that you're really working. It's almost, I think, a form of activism to want to kind of get out of that easy, what we'll talk about as the default mode of how we can have these narratives about the people around us, the experiences around us, and then how we kind of move out of those and expand our direct experience and our ability to tolerate discomfort and to try to kind of move into new unstuck places. So I think that is really relevant to our lives today. And that is one of the reasons I wanted to have you come so much. And I may have mentioned this in the materials that some of you read before coming, but it's really no exaggeration to say that Norm's work has really changed the course of my own. And prior to meeting Norm, I had been tracking this thing that I thought of as embodied awareness in the students in my classes and also in my private work. And when people would come into class a little bit scattered, and then when they would kind of what I call drop in to their bodies, which would be a different moment for most people. But there was something very distinct and very, you know, deeply therapeutic about that moment. And people would actually talk about that to me and how it felt to them. And when I met you, Norm, I learned from you that there was a scientific term for that awareness called interoception, and it was a whole field of study that you were really involved in. And that was really super exciting to me. And really changed the way I taught, the way I did teacher training. So you have all these recipients of your work that exists out in the yoga world that have been teaching to other people and doing private work in this new way because of your work and who you are. So I think that is just, that's something that I'll always be very grateful to you for. So I'd love to kind of take as a springboard, your 2010 study, which to me was like very revolutionary, and was so influential to my work. And then if you could sort of talk a little bit about the surprises in that study and the insight that it offered to you, particularly with regard to depression. And in some ways, I feel like you, in that study with Zindel Siegel, you redefine depression and you also kind of identify clearly that one of the elements of mindfulness training that was so important was the body. So can you share with us about that study and what you feel is important to take away?
Sure. Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me, boy. I'm really grateful. It's been lovely to know you over the years and continue to correspond. And thank you everyone for coming today. We'll try to make it worth your while. Yeah, it's been quite a ride from 2010, I guess. And the sort of background there is I was a graduate student trying to find a way to make sense of what was happening early in meditation, mindfulness training specifically, with somewhat naive ideas, kind of looking at it from the outside in. I had some background in psychology and philosophy, but, and, you know, I did yoga at the gym kind of thing, but I wouldn't say I was deeply steeped in the mysteries of contemplative practice. And so like many people, I had this lay theory and my mentors also had this theory, that the problem a lot of times when we run into trouble with mood is about the stories we tell ourselves. And that seemed like a tractable thing that we could study, because we knew that there was already research showing that when people made self judgments, like I'm good, I'm bad, I'm lovable, I'm worthless, there's particular parts of the brain that would be involved, especially right here in the medial prefrontal cortex. And so we had this working theory that if that was too extremely activated, if you're too deeply steeped in self-evaluation, well, that must be the problem. And this fits very well with, you know, very general tropes about meditation of sort of embracing the no self or the illusion of the self. So if you could break down this network that's doing selfing, that would be a well-adjusted, happy person. And that, you know, people who get too far into self-reference get into trouble. So we did this study in 2010 where we tried to have a lab or in the scanner version of making people temporarily depressed. We show them these really sad film clips. I won't do any impressions today, but the early 1980s is a great place to go for these long burn themes of loss that aren't like violent or gory or shocking, but are still really, really sad. And we compare that to like home and garden television. And you could show that people's self-referential networks are going wild when they watch these film clips in the scanner. And people sort of in general would report, yeah, like I'm a 5 out of 7, a 6 out of 7 for sadness. You made me really sad. Thanks. In the scanner. And I spent a long time trying to show that, trying to show what we thought was going to happen was that the more people activated these self-referential networks, so judging like, well, what does this have to do with me? How do I relate to this sadness I'm feeling from the film to my own life? To show that the magnitude of that activity was predicting who is depressed in our sample and who wasn't. Because a lot of the whole sample of participants were people who had signed up to do mindfulness-based stress reduction. People tend to sign up for courses like that when they're kind of stressed, right? So it's a mixture of depression, anxiety, and chronic pain. And I'd say it's been at least 6 months trying to show that medial prefrontal cortex, that self-activation was the problem, and just failing to do so and getting more and more frustrated. And my advisor being like, oh, run it again, you know, tweak some parameters, you know, I'm sure it's there, you know, that's got to be the story. And then one day, you know, I just kind of gave up on that having to be the story, probably just out of frustration and exhaustion, not some like greater enlightenment. And I was like, well, what else is going on in the brain when people get upset by watching these film clips and they get really sad? And sort of, it just became, as soon as I was willing to see it, it kind of just showed up that there's all these other parts of the brain that we're deactivating, that we're turning off. And especially we saw that this deactivation was happening a lot in sensory parts of the brain, which are really distinct from the conceptual parts of the brain. A lot of the back of our brain is dedicated just to having these factories that break down vision and hearing and touch and the internal sense of the body. In fact, only smell gets to be have a factory in the front of the brain, right at the top of the nose. Everything else, even vision, goes through like stereo cables to the very back. And so you can see, especially the body surface and internal parts of the body were turning off as people were saying they were more sad. And this response actually was much more variable. So everyone was doing it a little bit, but some people were doing it much more than others. And when I looked at the magnitude at which people were turning off sensation in response to this appraisal, like, oh, I'm feeling sad right now, that was really shockingly strongly predictive of how depressed they were. And so the thing that I couldn't see when we were so focused on like, oh, the problem is that we tell a self story or make self judgment, was that there's a second response to stress, especially sad mood, negative mood, that also involves blocking out sensation, which is probably, you know, at the start of it, protective. Like, I feel sad. It's intense. I want to get away from the sensation. But when you don't even worry about why, and you just think like, well, which of these two patterns, like self-judgment versus sensory inhibition, is correlated with how much you're suffering outside of the scanner task, it's 100% definitely the sensory inhibition. It's everyone is telling self stories, and that doesn't differentiate who's really suffering after that moment versus another. It's almost natural, or it seems, almost obligatory that we try to make sense of our emotional experience. So we've been pathologizing the wrong thing, and we didn't even realize the second thing was happening, right? We thought like, oh, when you become sad, it's too much feeling, and it's our job as adults to, you know, control this feeling from becoming too intense. And what the data was showing is we've actually become much too good at controlling it, so good that we don't even realize we're doing it. And so with this initial protection from having to have that sad feeling persists over time. And what we don't realize is that in shielding ourselves from negative feelings, we're also shielding ourselves from all of the new feelings that are occurring. And what started to emerge in like the decades since is this idea that like, really, that's where change is coming from. We think we reason ourselves into different states of mind, but no, you discover you feel differently, and then you try to rationalize and explain it into all this self-reference. So when we block out this kind of sensation, we're actually shutting the doors to change. And so if the last thing you noticed was you feel really sad or down or hopeless or lonely or disconnected, you've condemned yourself to keep feeling that way because you're not going to get new information that you feel differently. So there's an irony to being really successful at protecting yourself in the moment from feeling, and that you're also resigning yourself to continue feeling that way in the future, because who knows, the next thing that you feel could be even more threatening. So that's not what people are intentionally doing. That's the consequence of an understandable momentary need to sort of break away from the negative feeling. And as you see, that's a very different way of looking at depression, because a lot of times as we focus on the things that are obvious to us, like rumination, negative self-judgment, all of this sort of self-castigation that's apparent, but that almost seems like it's natural. And what actually becomes pathological is doing that while closing yourself off to the possibility that there could be new thoughts or experiences in the future. So not getting too judgmental about self-judgment, but rather considering, all right, am I still open to other thoughts and feelings down the road, is really what's missing for a lot of us, because it's more insidious as the sensation drops out. It's very obvious when we're having the judgments. So yeah, it was very hard for me to see that pattern of results. But once I saw it, it started to make all these things start to kind of fall into place and make sense.
It's so profound. I mean, as many of you know, I started out as a psychologist, where that's the existing paradigm, is that these are problematic thought patterns and we need to address them through, you know, cognitive means or cognitive behavioral means. So it felt really courageous to me for you to be saying, well, there's this other paradigm. And I love how in the book you stretch that concept and really talk about depression as the absence of embodied feelings, and that it's possible to reclaim those feelings. And that just feels like it's a wonderful opportunity for us as a society to kind of move beyond this idea that there's a chemical imbalance in neuromodulators like serotonin and norepinephrine, and that we need to address depression that way, because we know that that's actually now being thought of to be not as connected, and that there may be other incidental factors that explain why antidepressants work in the people that they work for. So I'm wondering if you can, you know, and also I think just to highlight something that you talked about, and maybe you can tie this together. But one of the really beautiful insights of the book for me is this quote within the pages that I kind of pulled out, where you and Zindel said, like, what if you're stuck only because you've stopped exploring? And I think those two ideas kind of bounce off each other. Can you riff on that a little bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, looking at things at this sort of systems level of analysis doesn't invalidate that, you know, there's going to be chemical and even structural changes in the brain. It's sort of my perspective is like, but what you can't do anything about that, right? I mean, you can take drugs, like people are definitely pushing drugs, but there's very little agency in being like, oh, it's a physical change, right? And so that may be true. And, you know, let's focus our efforts on where we have some ability to affect things, which is often with, you know, our attention, our intentions and our behavior. If you really take on the idea, like not even like it has to be 100% true, we just play with the idea that sensation is where change comes from. Like that we come from, we live in a rationalist society where we think we reason our way into change. But if you think about any major inflection point in your life, it's almost always like something from the world broke through and forced you to, like, it confronted you, your experience confronted your model of the world and shattered it a little bit. It wasn't like, I don't know anyone who was like, oh, I was sitting on the couch and I really thought about things and then I just changed my worldview. And trying to argue with people with different worldviews, like it's like the symbols you pop out of your mouth or write on a page, they don't change people's models of the world, right? Like maybe a very talented, you know, writer or something that brings people to simulating like an experience. And then again, that experience kind of changes them. So if we start from that perspective, that it's direct experience, the things that we sense and sense from the world that come in that challenge our internal models, then this idea that this is the way to change ourselves kind of make it follows from that idea. So when we feel stuck and we wish things were different, what that means is we already have a model of the world or gives us a set of expectations that is dissatisfying or distressing, both. Don't know how to change that model, right? So we think, you know, here's the way I wish things were. So that's just my desire, my what I'm yearning for. And then here's how I actually believe things are. That's the model. And there's this disconnect. And so I'm going to suffer because I want them to be this way, but they're not. But neither of those things is the world, right? And we're just like, I wish things were different. But if you really wish they were different, you'd be like, well, where would I find evidence that updates my model of the way things are, right? So that doesn't mean like you just magically change things. In fact, it's the opposite of that. You would actually have to go find evidence from the world that made your model closer to the way that you wanted things to be. And if you made those things closer together, you would suffer less, you would be more content. In a situation where exactly how you want things to be is the way you think they are, the way you model them, there's nothing you have to do. You're just like, exact, perfect. That's what I wanted. So it really starts to change the way we think about handling our distress. It's not even about what someone else did in the past or what we did in the past or something like that. It's like, where can I find information right now that's going to change the way I see the world? And really internalizing the belief, because none of the practices we suggest make sense unless you kind of at least are trying on this belief that you have to go explore things through your senses and take in new information. And your attention to that sensory information, the strong version of the theory is that is enough to start changing you, even though it's not going to be obvious how it happens. And it involves a loss of control because you're letting the world in. You're not defending the things you control, which are the things inside your head. So it really starts to have a lot of powerful implications for how we think about our own agency, I think. And it's not always what we thought. It's not that if I could make the world fit my model that things would be better, because that happens some of the time. Like I'm hungry and I have bread, I can make a sandwich, right? So I can change, you know, something in the world that I don't have food, now I have food. But many other things are about the model is disconnected from our values or what we want. And then at the same time, we either don't know or don't want to relinquish enough control to let that model be changed by the world. And that's very different than I'm going to go make the world change to conform with my model. It's like maybe something in me has to change so I stop having this disconnect. Hopefully that's sort of making some sense.
So much sense. It makes me think of one of my favorite terms that relates to depression is counterfactual processing, which is where we actually go into an event in the past and reimagine it the way we would like it to be, which is very counterproductive. And so all these mental kind of machinations to make things fit this kind of space of comfort that aren't working, but also that society tends to kind of emphasize, you know, we don't get a lot of messages growing up that tell us that our senses are safe or worthwhile engaging in, or that even incorporate sensory training into curricula. I know that they're doing that in Australia in their school systems, but in the US, I don't see much of it. I do see mindfulness, and that's starting. I just want to double click on something that you said. Which is that in depression, it's kind of adaptive to kind of shrink in and to cut off the difficult experiences in a way, like it's a coping strategy, even if it's one that isn't working well. And that kind of reminds me of the connections between depression and inflammation, mm-hmm. and that kind of withdrawal, you know, and immobility is what's called like a sickness behavior that's adaptive, that's designed to kind of get energy back, but even though it may not. And one of the tools I love the most in your book is when you talk about novelty in sensation. And you probably don't remember this, but right after, it was in 2014, right after a conference, the Mind and Life conference, where we were at, I think it was the very next day, I was in a car accident and I broke my wrist on the dominant hand. And you were really sweet. You reached out and said like, oh my gosh, what's happening? But that experience, I had to do things with my non-dominant hand over and over again. And I remember the frustration and the discomfort and how hard it was. And then there was a moment on the train to New York where everything sort of clicked. And I had this immediate mood boosting effect of using my non-dominant hand. And I really found that to be a kind of seminal experience in teaching me about novel movement. And you mentioned doing things with one's non-dominant hand as part of this menu of sensory experiences. And mm-hmm. I would love if you would talk more about like, how do we expand the menu? And also just have to say, like, it's very cool that you're not in the book limiting us to interoception alone, but there's movement, there's visual exercises, auditory and tactile exercises. Like, I feel like you're really teaching us how to access that back part of the brain, you know, and develop this fuller menu. It's really not restrictive the way we can sometimes find in certain books. Can you say more about this menu and kind of your intentions behind it? Or any angle of that you want to talk about.
Yeah, no, thanks so much, Bo. And hopefully your wrist is a distant memory now. You're just even more ambidextrous than you would have been before. Yeah, again, it's and it goes back to what you said, I think, a little bit earlier, is we just don't have a lot of encouragement to treat taking in new sensory experiences as something that's useful as we get older. Like, of course you have to know like where the door frame is or like what you're doing on the road or something like that, but this idea of using sensation for exploration is sort of something we're supposed to get over because we're supposed to move into like an accurate model of the world because it's so much faster and it's controllable and it's predictable, right? And so to go back into sensation is effortful, and even not even just culturally, like evolutionarily, we're trying to like conserve energy, right? And so we can stay alive and reproduce. Those are like the two main things we're sort of evolved to do, is don't die, pass on your genes. And so it's really effortful to go from a place where things are automatic and predictable and known. And, you know, like if I, you know, try to do something with my arm, it's going to go to the right place and it's going to grasp things. And then to move back to a place where like those things aren't really established routines. Yeah. We react in all kinds of different ways to what is essentially effort, right? That we don't know what's happening. We're not efficient. We're making mistakes. And that's because we are letting go of the need to, or we sometimes because of necessity to use the conventional model and take new information to update and form, you know, new ways of knowing. And so you might say again, like, okay, well, I just have to like think about having an open mind. There's this tendency again to always think like, I'm going to rationally just like think, see things from a different perspective. But literally, like, seeing from, how do you in the real world see something from a different perspective? You go somewhere else. Like, if I want to see my room from a different perspective, I need to walk across the room and look at it from a different perspective. I have to orient myself to a different way of taking in new sensory information. And not everything can happen at the level of metaphor. So if we want to learn how to use our body differently, we have to practice moving differently, right? If we, then that will change our relationship with our body. If we want to have different relationships with people, we can't always act the same predictable way when someone says something we don't like, or is aggressive to us, or whatever it is, because we're going to get the same result. That's like what we're, our most intuitive thing to do. Our most deeply ingrained habits have predictable results. That's why they're ingrained. So there's something that requires a bit of courage or abandon to say, like, I'm going to let go of knowing what's going to happen, because I know that I feel like I'm stuck somewhere that's not as good as things could be. And they could get worse, right? Like, I could try something different. I could try to pick something up with my non-dominant hand and lose my beautiful lunch or whatever it is. But I will never get better at using that hand. I'll never find another way to eat, right? I'll never find another way to relate to another person, if you want to generalize it into the relational space, if I'm not willing to give up on what's known and dissatisfying for the unknown. And that means it's not like things are always going to turn out better. Sometimes it will turn out worse. But a lot of times it's like, okay, right? And then sometimes it's worse, and sometimes it's way better. And that whole menu of possibilities is only open when you start allowing things to occur differently, which means I'm going to maybe act a little different, and I'm going to pay attention to different things. And so, yes, we do want to pay attention to our feelings, because ultimately that's where a sense of, you know, safety, security, well-being, and value lie. But that's not the only access point to changing how we relate. A lot of that happens out in the world. So how we move, you know, what body parts we use, what senses we attend to, what we attend to, even within a really familiar place, can shake things up. So even on a walk you've done 1,000 times, you could pay attention to different things. You could decide that paying attention to the sensory experience on the walk was more important than getting to the place you're used to going to, for instance, and that alone is going to change the dynamics of the walk. And then you may find yourself responding differently. It is this sort of radical act of saying, I'm going to prioritize novelty and discovery over the safety and security of knowing temporarily, right? It's very, very rare, almost never, do people lose the ability to go back into the model. That's the dominant mode. So it's like, you know, if you're going to think of it from the top down, would you dedicate 1% of your time, 5% of your time to novelty and discovery and change? Or is it going to just be 100% of time defending what's already known? And many of us live lives where unintentionally it's 100% of the time defending what's known, and everything else is a disturbance and a source of aggravation. But it doesn't have to be that way if we knew, if we valued it. Just like, you know, sometimes you could eat vegetables if you're on an all carb diet, but only if you value that as contributing something to your nutrition. So we have that knowledge that sometimes we do the thing that's uncomfortable in other domains, like physical exercise or nutrition, because it's been more culturally sort of integrated, where I don't think we necessarily have that at the level of like, well, where do I find, you know, meaning or creativity or connection in life? At these higher levels, we're still a bit backwards, I think, compared to how we've maybe understood that things at you know, what I put into my body nutritionally matters, or so on and so forth. Yeah.
I think that's such an important concept, because one thing I've noticed teaching internationally is how easily we can, and so just a couple, let me try to tease out what I'm trying to say. So one thing you're saying is that this doesn't, it's not about mastery of this, whatever this new realm is that we're trying to get to. It may not turn out well, it may turn out great. And also, you know, having taught in so many other places, I've had people say to me countless times, well, this isn't the way I learned how to do this pose or this sequence, or this is not what I'm used to. And so what you're also sharing with us is that there is some discomfort in going into the realm of novelty, because we do leave behind mastery and we do leave behind knowing, like, I'm just going to reach my arm out in this way and it's going to work perfectly. And so I think it's just really important to acknowledge that it may not be super comfortable in a society that wants us to always be in charge of execution of things. And I think about how, you know, my dad had a progressive neurological illness, which was a movement disorder, an ataxia that kind of went along with dementia. And what was really interesting is that we would do yoga together a lot. And it really taught me how, no matter where you are in terms of your ability, he was like often in a wheelchair toward the end of his life, but he would get out of the wheelchair and kind of use his walker as like a tool to kind of lift off of with his arms, and he could still get up and down off the floor. And those experiences were so cool for him and so mood expanding and world expanding that, you know, whether or not you're in a wheelchair or experiencing temporary disability or more permanent disability, these avenues are still really open to you for your whole life. They may just look a little different than what we've been trained they should look like in a society that can be a little bit ableist, if you will. So I just want to highlight that discomfort and how, if you are a movement or yoga person, often there's this temptation. I know I've experienced this, to think, oh, I've got that covered. Like, I can do the sensory thing just great. But what you're saying is, like, you're talking about finding the edge of that discomfort and kind of incorporating things that we're not used to doing. And the way, I don't know if I'm putting words in your mouth, but the way that that experience of kind of expanding a repertoire then kind of maybe trickles up to the brain in a way, you know, like that we're teaching ourselves these things through our bodies that then kind of have an effect on mood and thought patterns, as opposed to trying to go in through the mind and brain.
Yeah,
ignoring the body.
Definitely. We're trying, this is like, this is the, what we're trying to establish here is like, what is, we know the art of constructing things to be like solid and fixed. What's the art of plasticity, right? And a healthy person needs both of those skills. And I'm not trying to demonize, you know, having an understanding and having good habits, but I think you're pointing to really a crucial example that we're all inevitably either having gone through or going to go through, which is like, not, things aren't all going to keep getting better for us as we get older. Things are going to change, roles are going to change, and our physical ability is going to change. And many times it's going to change in a way that's constricting, right? I used to be able to do this, I can't do this anymore. That's that classic recipe. I ought to be able to bend and touch my toe on my right side. I did too many sports. I developed some arthritis in my right hip. And when I do a yoga class now, it's like, I have two bodies. I have my left side of my body, which does the things it's supposed to do. And then I have the right side of my body, which is like this weird, like regressive, it doesn't have the same range of motion it did before. So I can hold on to the model of like, my left side's right and my right side, there's something wrong with it. And then I'm going to suffer every single time, like suffer, not just like a twinge of pain or something like that, but suffer like at a deeper, like existential level, like there's something wrong with me because I've changed for the worse. Right. And that's a tough place to be, right? Right. Or like, my memory used to work great, now it doesn't work so great anymore. I used to have this relationship, I don't have this relationship anymore. So as long as we hold on to like, things were good then and now they're wrong. Like it's logical, it's rational that you will suffer. And so what is the art where you say like, well, why am I holding on to this model when I know it's not the way things are anymore? And you cannot, I really believe you cannot think yourself into acceptance. Acceptance is the process of having an experience and then not rejecting it when your pattern is rejecting it. And then maybe at one point, even like getting to the point where you authentically say yes to it. But let's be realistic. The first 10 times, 1,000 times might be like just trying to turn the volume down on shouting no to an experience that, because that doesn't fit some model of who you were in the past or how the world was in the past. And how do you do that practice? You have to really start to value sensory information as helping you to change, right? If when I can't move and my hip is saying, you can't do that anymore on this side, like, or just not even, you can't do this anymore. Like right now you can't do this. And like, and I'm actually like, okay, thank you for reminding me that like, I have a pattern that needs to change. That's a place of discovery rather than resentment. And it's not going to, and a lot of times it's still going to go back into resentment, but I know I have a practice where I can be like, sometimes I'm up for growing, right? If I can stay with the sensation and be like, what is it? What do I have to learn from this sensation? And that will slowly update my model. Now, what I would say is it's not every day, every second you're trying to find an edge, which is extremely effortful. It's not sustainable, right? And a lot of things we try to explore in the book is a lot of this practice, like anything, you want to have a place where it's safe or maybe even fun and inviting to practice, right? So that when you hit these places that are distressing, you have some wherewithal to do that, right? So that's why we'd invite people to find things, especially outside of their own heads, outside of their own bodies, that make it easier to practice this feeling of discovery, the saying yes to things. And there's lots of things in the world that are like that, that are, you know, at least not harmful and maybe downright wholesome, right? So like getting outside, doing some kind of new exercise practice, appreciating art, talking to people that you already love and connect with, and using those as a way to actually practice. Like, I'm really going to be here for this sensation, the discovery, because it's already like copacetic. It already feels good to do that. But I'm doing this because I am trying to develop this mastery, because I know what it's like to make that move into sensation in a place that's safe and inviting. And that becomes, and so that for some people, that's formal meditation. But part of why you wrote the book is you realize that like for less than 1% of the population, probably it's going to be formal meditation. Like most people hate formal meditation. I get that, like as a meditation researcher. And so this perverse project that like, you know, a lot of mindfulness teachers kind of have is like, we're going to get the whole world to enjoy meditation. It's not going to work, right? And not everyone's going to love yoga, and not everyone's going to love fine art or classical music or whatever, or forest bathing or whatever it is. But my belief is there is something sensory for everyone where it feels safe and it may even feel fun and enjoyable. And that becomes your workshop, your gymnasium. And then when you go, like for me, then when I go into my hip and it's like crappy, right? And I'm just like, oh, damn it. I can be like, okay, but I have a skill set that I can bring in sunny day on in sunny kind of situations that I can bring here too, where it's just like, can I just let go of the resentment for a second and actually treat this as a chance to take in new information and grow. And sometimes the answer is no, and I have to do other things just to calm myself down. But sometimes the answer is yes. And you go for the victories where you can get them. And those are the moments where you change, right? And there's other times it's so overwhelming, you just need to find some relief. So, you know, one really common example that comes up is people in their phones or people in their vices, like a glass of wine or something like that. And I'll say, it's like, sometimes you just need to like watch stupid television and like have your glass of wine and do whatever it is, because you're so dysregulated already. You're not able to put in any effort and really discover and change, and don't beat yourself up for that. And the other times you go on your phone and you're like, I'm actually going to just like use this as a chance to notice, like when I watch a dumb video, like, what does it really feel like to take in this information and feel something funny, as opposed to like confirmed funny swipe, confirmed funny swipe, which is what like kids are doing all the time. When I actually drink that wine, I'm not just waiting for it to numb me out. Like, can I actually do the thing I see people do on TV and like taste it? Right. And so you find places of meeting sensory experience with the effort level you have. And the project is like, the goal is to at least be doing that some of the time. And over time, moving into that mode does become easier. Like I can say from research and from my own personal experience, but it's not necessarily always available. It depends on, you know, how much energy you have and where you're in and how much distress you're already in. So sometimes just going into sensation or going into an activity just for relief is okay. And other times you're going to use it as that chance for insight, as that chance for discovery and growth. And if you're doing that some of the time, that's better than doing it none of the time. That at least means some of the time you're growing and some of the time you're just trying to relieve distress and protect yourself, right? And again, life is made of balancing those things.
It's so important what you're saying about this balance between safety and familiarity and then the novelty.
Right.
I remember when I first fell in love with novel movement and sensory experience, I wanted that to be like 75% of class, and people were not happy. And so my students have been really generous teachers to me and kind of saying like, okay, that is too much. We need more like familiar ground, which was really important. And I also, you know, I remember, so I've had like many hip surgeries for different like congenital reasons. And I've always taught on crutches after that. And I remember one day trying to get people to In the transition from downward dog into a lunge, where people just automatically fling a leg forward so it would make it all the way there to their hands, I just decided to show people where I could go, which was like a foot and a half forward, and then how I would like navigate the rest of the way. And it was very profound because after that class, people came up like in tears saying like, I wasn't really able to not make it to my hands until you show that you can't make it there. And so what you're talking about too, excuse me, a little froggy today, is a kind of relationality with our bodies and with what we can do and when, and that we're kind of in community reminding one another that it's not about like achievement and again, performance, but that it's about relationship over time and how we respond when something isn't maybe flowing the way we would want it to. So I feel like that's a really, excuse me, key message. And also, I feel like this message about being able to reside in difficult spaces is really important. You know, one of the critiques of modern mindfulness is that it's kind of trying to make us really over-regulate and feel better about things that are really kind of concerning or unjust. And that sometimes kind of residing in that place of friction, I guess you could call it, is important. Yeah, so I'm thinking about that, and then also in one of the tools I love the most in your book, and some of my teacher training peeps will recognize this, is that you mentioned a tool for change that we've used perhaps in a maybe slightly different flavor in my community to help people develop awareness between like where we are now and where we're going, and we called it toggling. And so it was amazing to see you talk about that very word, toggling, in your book. So can you describe the tool of toggling and how you're using the term and why it's so like fruitful and generative and important? Is that like, yeah, would that be helpful to people?
I think so. And because I think that there might be a tendency, this happens a lot in contemplative practice, is to say, well, if I just went completely into the sensory non-dual awareness, you know, that would be great. It would be utopia. And I'd be like, no one's going to grow food. Like no one's going to stop someone else from doing something bad to someone else. Like, you know, in this non-dual awareness, like everything is everything. So that's where we can have this kind of like richness and discovery and growth, and there's non-judgment, which is really, really important. And so it's important for us to learn this mode, but that doesn't mean we abandon having models of the world and having values and standards. And so the idea of toggling is realizing that it's part of who we are is this model, right? That's how we don't even see things really. We see how sensory information matches or mismatches the model. And so we are both these things. We're the chaos of the world coming in, right? That's part of who we are. And that's the sort of sensory exploration side of us. And we are also the model, and to abandon that would also be pathological. So if when the model is overdeveloped, we have anxiety and depression and disorders like that, where we have overdetermined patterns of ruminating about the past or worrying about the future. But if you take people who go completely to the place where those models disintegrate, you have like depersonalization, derealization, where nothing matters, nothing means anything. It's a kind of like nihilism escape into sense, nihilistic escape into sensation. Also not good, right? So toggling is recognizing that there's this teeter totter, right? This balance between these systems. That in a healthy person is trying to find that balance. And most of the times when we feel unhealthy, things have either gotten too wild, right? And uncontrollable, and there's too much coming in, it's overwhelming. And then we try to find refuge in something stable, or things have become so stable, this is harder to recognize sometimes, that things seem disconnected and hopeless and meaningless and languish and all these kind of things. And toggling is realizing that there's a move to rebalance things, right? So when I feel stuck, that means things have become overdetermined, and it's time to toggle into sensation and discovery and let go of the reins a little bit and let ourselves be changed, because we know we're not satisfied in the stability that we've found. And when things seem so chaotic and you know, we have no idea what's going on, that's time to try to actually form knowledge and update our beliefs, knowing that no one belief is going to be correct or right, you know, permanently all the time. Right. But what that toggling allows then is for us to have a belief system, a model of the world that's also flexible when we start realizing it's not working for us. So toggling is a sort of that higher level commitment to, now I have two skills. I have the ability to refine knowledge and rationalize and conceptualize, and I have the ability to break down my concepts and open them up for modification by moving into the sensory world. And so rather than think that I'm going to get really good at one and derogate people who do the other, which we tend to do, like in group and out group everyone, but it comes down to like really old wisdom. And actually the whole idea behind toggling, I think, links directly into the serenity prayer, right? Which is, I'm going to maybe not say it exactly right, but you say like, you know, I want to know which battles I'm supposed to fight, like when I'm supposed to get out in the world and fight for the things I really want, like, Lord, give me the wisdom to fight the battles or make the change in the world that I'm supposed to have. And also give me the wisdom to accept things when there's nothing for me to do other than change my expectation that they're going to be different, right? Which is the sensory updating. And then wisdom is to know, you know, which one to do. Right. And you're hoping, like, you're hoping you're toggled in the right direction and you don't make things worse by going deeper into a model when the model needs to change, or abandoning the model when there's something really important about who you are fundamentally that you don't want to just give up. And so each of us has to make that determination all the time. And what seems like it's not helpful is to assume that we just always want to double down on one system versus another. And most of the time in the West, we're doubling down on let's protect the model and get mad at the world for not meeting it. So the wisdom comes in realizing we should be moving in both directions, and we'll feel good when there's a balance, when we know things about ourselves, but they're not, that we don't feel like we would be destroyed if we had to change one of those things.
I love that. And I want to also confess that you've been so instrumental in, excuse me, in kind of reminding me that like sensory exploration isn't doesn't exclude cognitive processing, like the cognition and kind of putting a frame around that experience and understanding it is compatible. So there are cognitive levels where we're processing interoception. And every time I get overexcited about sensory awareness, you've been just so beautiful and are saying like, well, yeah, just keep in mind that, you know, you can still have cognition here in these places, you know, as a kind of structure. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think so. Believing any one thing is the thing is probably going to get you, you're going to find times that it's not like, we need multiple tools for navigating through life. And this is at least a cartoon kind of dichotomy, but still a really important realizing that you can take things too far either way. And I come from a place where I had a very, very rational like top down dad and a very emotional, like validate my emotional experience kind of mom. And so, I grew up as a kid trying to like be like, okay, I'm not choosing one of you as being the right parent, right? And both of you have suffer in different ways. So we can still be open to, the sensory world, the feeling world, and realize that that's a source of knowledge, right? And we can be open to the rational world, realizing that people can reason themselves into terrible situations also. And there's times when you need to pay attention to that visceral signal. And then there's just so many life examples where that happens, right? Where you win an irrational argument, you lose a relationship, right? And then you, at the end, you're like, oh, actually the feeling in the relationship was what was more important to me. Why did I defend reason so strongly when by being right, I lost what actually mattered? And other times it can be like, well, I needed to tell the truth of my emotional experience so much that I just shattered a whole bunch of commitments I made because I really didn't like it at the time. And now I have to pick up the pieces. And that's also being like, yeah, sometimes it matters that you promise to do something just because you really powerfully feel something doesn't mean that the world has to shift around that either. It's important to sort of contextualize that with like, well, how does that interrelate to all the other complexity and things you know about the world and cause and effect? So it's important to give each of the spotlight on each part of ourselves, and we're going to mess it up, right? Like, but at least we're trying to realize that there's a tension between these things, the sensory and discovery and feeling state and knowledge and rules and commitments and logic and moving into our senses as a way of unsticking ourselves from, inheriting a whole bunch of reasons or lines of argument that really don't fit with us. So yeah, we talk mostly about sense forging because we think the imbalance tends to be on the rational side, but it doesn't mean we abandon the rational side either.
I love that. I have to say that the exercises in the book are so are kind of scaffolded with so much care in a way that's like really unusual. And literally you could return to them over and over again, as opposed to like sometimes you just get here's one exercise and then here's another and they maybe don't relate, but you really sequence them in a beautiful way. And there's one in particular element of the exercises that I wanted to talk about that I've never seen before in a science-based self-help or any self-help book for that matter, that I found really absolutely genius. And I can't recall where in the book it starts, but it kind of hit me suddenly that you have this contrast between a tired version of sensory exploration and what you call a wired version.
Yeah.
And I interpreted the former as like a kind of rote, habitual, almost like resentful way of approaching sense foraging, where you're just checking a box and doing it almost on autopilot, versus what I experienced as a really open-doored kind of perceptual way. And it was so brilliant. And it made me think about the way it's very easy for us to kind of feel like, oh, I know that terrain, there's nothing new there for me, and how that can kind of shut down the very novelty that you talk about as being transformative. Can you bring that contrast to life a little bit for us?
Right. Yeah. No, thanks so much for bringing that up. Yeah, that distinction tired versus wired, and we're trying to be like cool. But also like it was later in the book, we're talking about access points, which is like finding the types of sensory practices that are going to work for you. And you can just do them by rote, right? So like I might say, look around your room and or whatever environment and try to find something you normally don't pay any attention to, right? So that would be a very simple sense foraging kind of practice to just get you into a sensory mode. And the tired way to do it is like you do it and you're like, now where's like, you put your hand out and you're like, now where's my happiness, right? Like, and it's just like, it's becomes this transactional thing where like, you told me I would do this and I would do X, I'd get Y, and you're just like still stuck in like modeling and expectations space, right? And that the distinction between tired and wired is like really taking on the intention. This is the thing that we actually have the most control over, that really what I'm hoping for here is a chance to be surprised and discover something. And that's where like the juice is, Right. So you can, like, I can move my eyes around the room and find something that I know, like, the frequency at which my eyes fixate on it is low. Now I've completed the task. Like, where is my happiness? Right. And but at that, there's, I'm actually, like, not trying to discover something there. Right. I'm just trying to, like, be a good student. And we do this so much of the time, like, it's like performative, right? As opposed to thinking, like, I wonder if I could see something, like, or see something in this room from in a perspective I've never seen before. I wonder, like, how I would, what feeling would come after that, and what thoughts would come after that. And, like, you know, I've never looked at this one shoe before. Whose shoe is this? Right. Sorry, I have a little, like, mud room area on the left of me here. And just, like, when's the last time anyone wore that? And, like, where were we? And what does it remind me of? And then my mind just can go in places, not like they're, like, brilliant insights. I'm going to discover some general theory of relativity. They're just going to take me places I wouldn't normally go. And what I'm really valuing is that I'm having this kind of novel break from the routine. And all of a sudden, the boring, like, it is explicitly, like, objectively boring to notice a shoe. You know what I mean? It's not anymore, because I'm inside the experience. And one thing I think that I've learned, whether it's right or not, this is my understanding of, like, a lot of contemplative practices, is the thing that you really have control over is just how you come to meet an experience, right? Like, so if you're doing loving kindness practice, the thing you have control over is, do you really intend to send out a feeling of love and compassion? Whether or not you feel great afterwards, like, not up to you really a lot of the time. And so the wired thing is, like, put your effort into the thing where you can control the outcome. And but the somewhat weird, like, perverse thing is, it's the outcome isn't the outcome. The outcome is, like, the starting point. That's the part where you control, right? So I can control, like, am I authentically approaching this exercise with curiosity and a willingness to be surprised? I can control that part of it. Whether or not I get surprised and discover something, or it turns out to just be like, yep, there's a shoe there, and I move on, I can't control that part of it. So where I can make sure I have a win is, like, did I set myself up? Like, that's the practice. Did I set myself up to be receptive to taking in something new? And sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. And the way I think about it is, if you do that authentically, you've at least raised the chance of discovery, of having a new experience, of changing yourself from, like, zero to non-zero. And then sometimes it'll be like 100, and sometimes it'll be like 0.01, but, like, it's still something where there was no possibility for change before. So while you're just setting yourself up for that receptiveness, and what I really believe is, and I've seen it in my own life, is if you set up some sort of habit of looking for something in with a non-zero possibility in the world, it will show up. Not in a mystical way. It's just, there's, like, a bazillion things happening all the time every day, and we're filtering it down to very small few. If you're really open to that thing, sometimes it will be a lot different than zero, and sometimes it'll just be zero, but you'll never notice it unless you get yourself into that place of, like, I'm willing to have a non-zero possibility of discovery in whatever domain it is that I care about. And you can get better and better at noticing the things you tune yourself to notice. So that gets us into the sort of more rarefied air of, like, now I'm developing some expertise in sense foraging.
No, that I've ever seen the distinction so eloquently, or maybe even at all, as opposed to like this outcome based, like do this and you're going to get this. And I found it really useful and very generative in terms of like pointing us to immersion, a kind of wholehearted engagement in the endeavor, as opposed to here's an exercise, I'm going to check the box and then, and then maybe I'll abandon it if it didn't quote unquote work, which was really useful.
Right. If the game you're playing is, like, I want to be into a state where I can change myself, then start with changing yourself. Start with, like, being like, I'm not gonna see, like, it may show up as boring, but I'm not gonna start off anticipating boredom. Like, I'm gonna change myself from a place of resignation, or not, or even just knowing. It doesn't mean resignation, to just a place of not knowing. And that shift is the shift into sensation, into receptivity, into plasticity. And it can become more familiar, and you can get better at it, but it's already available if you're doing it for the first time, right? Just, like, do you want it bad enough? Are you resigned enough that things could be better than the way they are now, that they're stuck, that you're willing just for a second to let go and move into a place where you're willing to change? And then, like, that's the move. And then if you do that over time, things will change. Right? Your attention is sufficient when it comes from a place, an authentic place, to change your mind.
So, I really love that. It's also like the potential application of the tools I found to be like very wide ranging. There is a favorite anecdote that I have in the book, which is the chef Rene, who kind of finds himself maybe in danger of replicating the patterns that we know from TV shows with chefs, where there's this kind of like, you know, striving and perhaps even like abuse of the people around you. And he takes a break at what one might consider a bad time to do that, like just when he is kind of on the verge of something, and goes into the forest and starts sense foraging, literally, foraging for, you know, different foods. And it made me think about how for so many of us at this point in time, both through COVID and through other social factors, we are considering like, well, how can I serve in a different way? Like, and how can I be of use in the world? And so there's this idea of sense foraging as a way of kind of, without being outcome focused, kind of conveying us into this next thing by way of kind of sensing and feeling and allowing something to take form in an organic way that I found to be like very mind expanding and illuminative. And I suspect there are a lot of people on this call and who will watch later who are kind of wondering, like, in this world that we're living in, like, maybe what I've been doing is not what I'll be doing forever. And maybe it's time to kind of shift into something different. But that is really scary for all the reasons you talked about, and like utilizing sense foraging as a kind of vehicle or method of conveyance to get there just feels really powerful to me. And I wanted to bring that up as something that I really loved and will probably reread quite a few times.
Yeah, I mean, and truth be told, like the chef, he himself has oscillated from these patterns of discovery back into this kind of calcification, and eventually walked away from that restaurant. But at the time of writing it, it was like he was back on the upswing. So like, it's not, again, you move into sense foraging, then happily ever after, never have a problem again. But exactly as you say, but we're living in a time where it's very easy just to say, I reject the way the world is right now. Like I do not accept the way the world is right now. But just saying no to the way you understand the world creates a kind of powerlessness, right? Because you have powerlessness, yeah, because you have this understanding of the world, and you just say like, I don't want it to be this way, so you suffer, right? And maybe in many times are suffering for good reason, because the things we're aware of are not good things, right? There's atrocities and injustices, and we have enough technology now to bring it all to us every day, constant feed. Right. So part of that is knowing when just to not continue to take in conceptual information that's upsetting, because it's just dysregulating you. But that's it, if that's all you're doing, you're kind of putting your head in the sand. And so if the goal is to be an agent in the world for the things that you want, one thing we can think about is how much time are we spending actually being intentional about foraging, right? Like seeking out the way we want the world to be. So rather than just saying like, I don't want this, I wish things were different, which maybe is the beginning of a motivation, right? It's like, we're stuck. That's that feeling of stuckness, right? We're stuck in a way, and I know it could be better than this. So what's better? Well, I know what's better. So what is better? And pick something, right? There's lots of different ways things could be better. I wish people were more open, more loving, more honest. Cool. So that's the thing you want to forage for. Great. And then the thing is, you don't have, you're like, but I don't know what that looks like. I don't know how to get there. Perfect. So you know that like there's something you want that would make things better for you, right? Like in terms of how you see the world, how it could be better. And you don't know what it looks like. That is a great fuel for having an intention to move into this kind of foraging, right? And then where do you forage? You forage in real life, in the world that's around you, right? And so some of that could come in like keyboard activism and things like that, but most of it I think comes from like who am I interacting with every day? Like, what are my opportunities out in the world? And I'm going to tune myself to be receptive for where there's a chance for connection, right? There's a chance for honesty. There's a chance for love. There's a chance for generosity. And those chances are there if you're not so much as saying, like, not this, not this, protect, protect. But like, where are those chances? You're going to find those chances. They'll be in people you know. They'll be in people you don't expect. They might be with people you don't expect them to be. They'll be in actions you never expected yourself to take. And if you're open to those opportunities, I mean, another cliche that's not, that doesn't have to just be a cliche, is this idea of like, success is preparation meeting opportunity, right? So the preparation you can make is preparing yourself to know what you're looking for in the world that would be better than this, as opposed to just saying not this. And then you're just waiting for the opportunity, and then you're ready, right? You're ready for those successes, and those successes can be very, very modest, right? It can be like a little act of kindness, a little act of generosity, a little time when you show honesty where you would normally hide something because it maybe it's risky, and that's where your power is, right? And one thing I often would say to people, and they're like, oh, we have to, are we going to fix the world in this generation? It's like, that's not your job. Your job is to like try to express the values that you want to see for you in your life, and let other people live their lives. And if you do something that's like amazing, right, other people will want that for themselves too. It's not your job to live to control what other people do, right? So kind of be that person, right? And the way you find out how to be that person is by knowing kind of what you're foraging for, what you're up to, and then staying ready for those opportunities. And at a local, like, moment by moment level, they're there every day, right? And then they can build, right? And that's often how these things start. Very few people mastermind becoming the leader of some movement or something like that, right? It's just like they stumble their way choice by choice into that thing. And most of us don't have to do that to make a change. So it's moving into a place of empowerment by becoming clear about what we would like to see in the world, instead of always focusing our attention on wishing someone else were different.
Love that. And it's such a great kind of touchstone for how to move through this world that we're in, which is really rapidly shifting. I'm mindful of the time and I want to open things out, but I also wanted to share along those lines an experience that I had that the book sort of helped me put a frame around. And I haven't really talked about this much, but this may resonate with some of you, and I haven't really spoken about this, but over the past 18 months of speaking out about Palestine, I have gotten a ton of sort of initially and still actually hate mail and harassment from people that were employers and at national conferences and studios and yoga students and members of my community. And in the beginning of that experience, I had a lot of really, I would say, anticipatory fear and anxiety and discomfort and vigilance. And then that kind of, as I stayed with that, moved into kind of experiencing social ostracism from my in-group, which included yoga people, mindfulness people, and even other Jewish people. And I was My initial kind of approach was to want to push through that, to not really fully feel that. And as I became sort of more able to incorporate this wider range of sensations, particularly to kind of include and maybe even embrace this sense of ostracism or, what some people call social pain, I kind of remained in this a little bit of a limbo. And then the book helped me kind of toggle the rest of the way to something new. And instead of staying in that place, I think it gave me the freedom to forage a little bit more within that and to kind of organically allow the process to bring me to something that doesn't really have form yet, but that is a little different, which is less to do with this narrative of rejection or repression of speech, but like, what is it like to untether from a social in-group and all those norms, which is kind of a little bit of a default conceptual framework, and to kind of explore what it means to exist a little bit adrift from that, which is really a different feeling. I don't know where it's going to go because it's still very much in process, but in case that resonates for anyone else or people perhaps in the US and elsewhere that are going through these early versions of what looks like repression and trying to kind of figure out, well, how could this apply to the difficulty of activism in this moment, particularly when there is a price for speaking out, and so many of us have been trained not to do that. Anyway, I just wanted to highlight my gratitude for the model of sense forging, because it doesn't force a conclusion, as you talked about, like where there's this neat bow around everything, or even an understanding of like where is that going to go, or you know, how much of this can I tolerate, or this narrative, like this rejection narrative, which is kind of a narrative that's common in depression, just on a social scale. So I just wanted to really encourage people to know that this, even though it might not be a purpose of the book, like one of the beautiful nodes of generativity is how many places we can apply this. And you don't have to comment on that norm. I don't want to kind of push that framework here, but just to say how helpful I think it can be, even in places where we might not expect it.
No, I mean, thank you for being courageous and sharing your experience. And yeah, without weighing in on like, you know, politics specifically, I think it's natural for this to be scary, especially when we're talking about it at the level of like relationships and vocation, right? Like in your livelihood, and we all depend on each other, right? And feeling like some of those things are cut off is like, it's not like, oh, you're overreacting to be concerned and what am I doing? And so, yeah, I don't think the model is like, just go forage and like burn all the bridges behind you. But sometimes there is a sense of like, things are changing. Right. And sometimes you have to let go of the rope, right, to find out, you know, what comes next for you. And holding on to the very edge of the rope, especially when you realize like it's burning, right? Like it is not going, it's no place to live out the rest of your days. So in a way that's hopefully considered and not like just a total rejection of running away from the way life is, continuing to explore like what else is possible, which also I think, as you're saying, like sometimes means putting yourself out there and realizing that now that you're sort of expressing a different thing you're foraging for, there's other communities that you'll now be entering into, is part of that process. And there's going to be times that are just overwhelming where you might just use going into sensation as a just to get some relief and break out of the whole narrative completely. And other times you're going to go look specifically for like, what does this look like for me in the future? And now who are my people? And that's part of that exploration. And realizing that a lot of that pain and conflict, I think, as you just articulated it so well already, is from seeing, it's like a mourning almost for this model that was like safe and you thought that was going to be it, right? And now you're just like, maybe it's not, right? Like none of us want to live in a time when the whole world changes, but are we ready if it does, right? So
yeah,
we'll see, right? And we don't have to decide that everything is changing today, but we also don't want to ignore when change starts to come, and change always comes in small or big ways, and maybe more recently like in big ways. So trying to stay open and remind yourself, like, what am I foraging for in the face of this change, and not letting other people write that narrative for you. I think I wrote this in the emails, like everyone wants to tells everyone else how to live their life, but ultimately like you get to decide, and don't let people take that choice away from you. And there will be other people, you know, there's always boundary conditions, but for the most case, if you're doing it from a place of love and exploration, there's going to be other people that you discover for every person who turns away. So, yeah. And it's hard. So, I mean, just thanks for sharing it, but we're all kind of on that journey, I think.
And I just want to double click on what you just said and really like highlight that inquiry of, it's kind of like a, what would you call it? It's like a one of our primal questions. What am I foraging for in this situation that can change? And I just wanted to highlight how important that is to continue to kind of engage with and to ask. So thank you for that. And it wasn't until rereading the book that that started to coalesce in a different way. So
right.
I'm
and
really
also
grateful.
Not getting caught up in other people's, like other people are foraging for other things, like looking, you know, good or whatever, looking and doing the right thing on social media or whatever it is. And it's almost like if you clear that that's has nothing to do with what you're foraging for, you don't even always have, like, it, for me, it just frees up. Like, I don't even have to engage. Like, you said this thing to me and I'm just like, I don't even have to respond because it doesn't serve what I'm wanting. And I don't work for your agenda, like your agenda of being even in some dialogues, right? Like, it just, it's something that, right. So obviously we have to address like direct, you know, challenges to our livelihood and to our cherished relationships, but there's a lot of other places that are like bait. And if we're clear what we're going for, like we don't have to take that bait, and that just frees us up to do the things that we actually want to do. Cause more than ever, we're living in a world where there's very carefully constructed, like, I guess the series, the word like baits for us to get sucked up and to use all of our attention, all of our energy. And it, what it's doing is it's the loss of the opportunity to be the people we want to be. So like trying to hold on to that and finding communities that support you in that is so important. So I know it seems
I
like
love that.
You've already, you're and, fostering that community.
Yeah. And you use this beautiful term that I want to end with and then take questions, which was like, and it was a different context that we were talking about, but you use the term a visceral call to action. And I just wanted to kind of leave us with that, which is a kind of another way of saying, what am I foraging for? And knowing that we can forage amid that discomfort. So thank you for that. All right, we've done enough. It's been enough me. So let's, how might we do this? I think if you want to raise your hand, we would be happy to unmute you. I think I just raised my own hand. I'm gonna lower
you're
my hand.
You're demonstrating, yeah. Like so.
Okay. And I see a few already. So what I'll do is I'll just monitor the participant window, Norm, and then you can respond. So the first hand that I see, I'm going to take, which is Chelsea W. I'm going to allow you to talk and ask you to unmute, and you can talk. If anyone wants to just enter it in the chat, you can do that too. But it's also always lovely to hear you. Are you with us, Chelsea? Yes, you are.
You just
I
have
can
to
see
unmute.
You. You might have to unmute first.
Oh, how about now?
Yeah,
that's good.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for this. It's so important for everybody, and I absolutely don't want to minimize that. I just can't stop thinking about the applications with depression and clinical applications, basically. And I don't think you're a clinician, but I'm just really curious if there's been a line of research since that 2010 using this, or at least exploring how it could be used as treatment for depression, which would look a little different from, you know, just your typical
Sure.
person out there exploring this stuff, which is so cool, regardless of you know, what we're trying to treat. But and then if not, I'd be really curious how you would design a study like that.
Yeah, thanks so much for the question. So we have been continuing down the rabbit hole of depression, specifically around depression relapse and recurrence. So people who already have developed clear habits of being able to become depressed, as evidenced by them having had multiple episodes in the past. And we see this pattern not only persists, but intensifies. So for someone who has a history of depression, paying attention to their senses is not sufficient necessarily to fully rebalance the scales. What we see happening for people who have a history of 1 to 10, I would say, episodes of depression, and it gets stronger with every episode, the thing that they can do with their attention, first of all, is just to take their foot off the inhibitory brake. So you're going to start addressing much earlier challenge to sense foraging, which is just, how do you even get yourself in a place where you're receptive to sensation? And that's going to be a lot of the initial training, and it's going to take more work and more time. In the same way that we see in recovery from addiction, for instance, someone who's addicted to methamphetamine, the reward centers of their brain stop responding to anything except for meth. And a month after they're abstinent, it's still not responding to anything after other than meth. But if they can stay off the drug for over a year, you start to see recovery. The brain starts responding to other things like puppies and babies and things like that. And in the same way, being in that place where you're now at least no longer reflexively pushing away sensation creates a space where sensation can start to reemerge. And it may take a lot of support and time doing these kind of practices before something like anhedonia starts to light in, right? The ability to actually feel pleasure again, or feel like there's a sense of meaning or purpose. And we've compared in a study that we published a couple of years ago, a sort of wellness-oriented form of cognitive behavioral therapy, which had savoring practices where you actually go in and try to be like, do I get any return on things that I know might have given me pleasure before? We compared that to more mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. It turned out it didn't matter what type of one therapy wasn't better than another. It's just that when people responded, they responded by no longer using the front of their brains to inhibit sensation. But within 8 weeks, you don't start to see the full recovery of sensation like you would in a community sample. So there are already really good therapies that have sensory practices. Part of even the growth of behavioral activation therapy is about getting people to do things in the world to update their models. Like, I'm useless 100% of the time. But now with behavioral activation therapy, I go for walks. So I'm only useless 99% of the time. That will update the model. It is better to be useless 99% of the time than 100% of the time. Maybe tomorrow you get to 98%, and then it's going to take work, right? There's no quick solution. So I would recommend, on the face of it, giving people this maybe conceptual framework, but then you can still access a lot of high quality expert delivered therapies to start moving this way, as long as they have some sort of sensory exploration practice. So wellness-oriented cognitive therapy, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy have really good evidence bases already in depression. And then for what we're designing now, we're just starting to get to the point where we're like, well, how would we actually manualize like a workshop? Because it seems too daunting to come up with like a 2 month thing, and most people won't do a 2 month thing. So we have intentionally tried to move into the more for the every person in a preventative way, and what we're working on now. But we definitely have continued this work to look at depression in specifically, and not just community samples. If you email me later, I can send you some papers on that for sure.
Fascinating. So cool. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You can put your email, Norm, if you're not afraid of getting like 100 emails, I can
Well, I'm
put it
happy
in
to get
my.
them. I just it takes me a long time to get back to them. Yeah. I do my best to slowly respond. It just might be weeks later, like, oh, you're the 70th email. I'm finally getting to you. Sorry. But I'll try.
Okay. Is that cool, Chelsea? Did that sort of get at what you were looking for?
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, I see one from Alexi. I'm hoping I got your name right, the pronunciation. And I can allow you to talk and ask you to unmute.
Amazing. Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Perfectly.
Okay, thank you. So I work with the perinatal population, and I have really struggled to find people that are applying these sorts of practices to that period of life and getting specific about that transition, the hormonal components of it, and then specifically postpartum depression really piqued my interest if there is some sort of relationality in what's happening in the brain as far as what you guys are seeing. If you've seen or if you know of any resources in that area, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, great. So, not my exact expertise. The framework we think
Sure.
probably applies to lots of different places. The person I would check out that I know of most directly is Sona Demijan,
Okay.
which is University of Colorado Boulder, and she has developed interventions, and some of them are preventative interventions for even subpopulations they think are at higher risk for perinatal or postnatal depression, postpartum depression. So Demijan is I'm gonna mess up spelling
Got
it,
it now.
but oh, you found it.
Sonja. Okay.
Yeah. So I would check her out because she's definitely like part of our like we have very similar minds. She's a close collaborator of Zindel Siegel's, and she's done a lot of pioneering work in this area. So I think you'll find that she'll be able to speak to it much better than I can, and has a lot of research in that area.
Incredible. I'm in the Denver metro area too, so that is
There you go.
amazing.
It's stars aligning. Yeah.
Yes, definitely. I appreciate that.
I do see. So, if anyone wants to ask anything, you can raise your hand in the chat. And there's also a question here, Norm, that I happen to know that you addressed in the book, which is, do you recommend the use of psychedelics in depression? And if so, when? And I know you were like uber clear, like that was a very clearly stated and careful, conscientious portion of the book.
Yeah, so psychedelics generally degrade your ability, your brain's ability to inhibit connections. Inhibition is really important for constructing like boundary of one thing and the other thing, like where a table ends and your foot begins, for instance. So, they're going to be dysfunction at least temporarily from going into psychedelic state. But also, what a wonderful opportunity to have different types of experiences, right? So the psychedelic science, because of legislation against psychedelics, is still going quite slowly, and we don't know exactly how to do things safely, consistently. It seems very clear that if you have someone who can guide you and create a safe environment, so the classic terms are set and setting, so your mindset going in guide you psychologically, but also guide you into a physically safe space, you're much more likely to have some positive, meaningful experiences, and then it's going to wear off. Right. And then the question is, what happens after? Like after the ecstasy, the laundry. And that's where we really need to develop things more often, but to much more to figure out how do you now things could be different, but you're not different. The drug came out of your system. Are you just going to be high all the time? That doesn't seem probably practical or like a good idea. So, what is the, but you have this attractor state of realizing that things can be so profoundly different. In the same way that we see in yoga or meditation, someone has a relaxation response for the first time in 15 years, and they're like, oh my God, like I didn't know how stressed I was before. I didn't know how rigid I was before. You can have that experience in psychedelics, and that becomes this place you can see is possible. But then again, it's going to take work to change your sober, the way you are as a normal person, not high out of your mind, and all those patterns kick back in, all those inhibitory links and connections kick back in to slowly shift to become the kind of person who can experience that consistently. So that's why I think there's a lot of potential with psychedelics, because they can fast track you to be able to see things and sense things in a very different way. And it's not going to, I believe it's not going to take away the need to put in the work afterwards. To slowly and consistently make those kind of changes that you got this like fast forward glimpse of, and that's still going. And so I would not say that it's going to replace doing these kind of sense foraging practices. It could just become a really powerful motivator, because now you know experientially it's possible, right? But we know from another field, transmagnetic stimulation, for instance, it shakes things up in the brain. People who have treatment-resistant depression feel this lightness. And then 50% of people who don't respond to antidepressants or psychotherapy respond to transmagnetic stimulation. And then 80% of them, after a month of treatment, within the next year, go back and become depressed because they fall back into their old patterns. I think psychedelics is going to show the exact same profile until we develop not so sexy, one quick fix kind of science of like after that initial impact, how do you now start to chart a course for a sustainable change? So yeah, super great potential, and just the drug itself is not going to be the answer. That's going to motivate you maybe to do the work to get to the place where you do find access to the things you want in your life.
Yeah, we have a person in the US administration that might be demonstrating that difficulty right now, particularly with regard to ketamine. I won't mention names, but I think we all know who that is in the US. I see a question. Hi, Kimberly. I'm not sure what that question is. Could you rephrase that about the maintenance dose in the
Like
chat?
whether to keep taking the drugs to maintain benefits.
Oh.
It's possible, right? Ketamine specifically is a funny duck, because it has become off-label, like legalized much more quickly, because it was shown in animal models to actually promote brain growth, like neurogenesis, that had nothing to do with the subjective experience. Ketamine, as many of you might know, is actually like a horse tranquilizer. And so it's a dissociative drug. It's not necessarily creating all these kind of other sorts of experiences. So if it helps along that process of freeing up your mind for discovery, and it's done in a supervised way, I don't I don't have any like puritanical qualms about it. I just, again, stress that pushing yourself chemically into a different state is not where you're going to make change that matters in the world. It might just free you up to make those kind of changes. The work still has to be done because most of your happiness and suffering is happening in your relationships, not while you're in the clinic on the drug. So if these become like little booster packs and it's done in a safe kind of way and it keeps that alive for you, like who am I to say don't do it, especially if it's like in a medically supervised way? I just, again, let's not confuse the catalyst with the actual tonic, right? Like not the thing that actually speeds things up. Like that's not, or gives you that window or that freedom. That's not actually where the work is. It's just gonna make it more easy to do the work. And I
You
think
did
is
a
it a bit
study, didn't you, Norm, on microdosing?
yeah, we're just finishing up a actual trial where we're giving people psilocybin and microdoses. And we've done a lot of survey research on it. From microdosing, we know that it's quite helpful for about two-thirds of the people who microdose, and for about a third of people, they get the opposite of what they want. They get more anxious or more distracted. So it's not clear why that happens. In the study we did, we found that there were some benefits to taking microdoses of psilocybin over an 8-week period for people with treatment-resistant depression, but those benefits were not the real story. The real story, because of the regulations, is we had to have people in clinic for 8 hours once a week, where they are getting a lot of attention, care, counseling, and doing a lot of assessment and participating in a meaningful role. And so, and with microdosing, you can have people in placebo and they don't necessarily know. And it actually didn't matter whether they're on the drug or not. The biggest effect was doing that role for 8 weeks, regardless of whether they were on placebo or not, was transformative for them. Right. So putting in an 8-hour day once a week where you're considering how your mind works and getting support from other people, smart people, interested people, young people, that's therapeutic, and it's not a sexy solution, right? It's like, yeah, you spend a day a week working on yourself with other people who are helping you and interested in you. That's the big change in their symptoms. And there's a tiny little acceleration if they happen to be in the psilocybin dose, but not enough that would be clinically significant. It's not what That's not going to make a lot of money for people in the way that giving you a psilocybin lozenge will. That's my understanding, is it's about putting in the work relationally to find and practicing finding yourself, finding meaning and finding connection with other people. That's curative. And the drugs can make that happen a little bit faster.
Let me think of the work of Robin Carhart-Harris, and he talks about the introduction of entropy as kind of a therapeutic element where these very like familiar patterns are disrupted and it kind of expands connections in a certain way. But it sounds like what you're saying is what you were saying about sense forging, that you really do need that work of integration and dedication and practice over time to kind of,
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of relief that comes from destabilizing like an overdetermined, negatively valenced model of the world, to be a little jargony, right? Like you have a really like depressive or anxious story that's just running you. The entropy, which means chaos, right, is a relief, because chaos is better than this like knowing that things are horrible or unsafe or you're unlovable or whatever it is. And that's the equivalent of saying like my garden is full of weeds. I've pulled out all the weeds now. Like I've killed the weeds. I've destabilized them. So now what do you have? You have a big patch of dirt. Great. Mission accomplished? No, like so necessary, but not sufficient, right? Great to break up those patterns. What are you going to replace it with? Randomness? Like see what just happens to grow normally. You know what you're going to get a year later? More weeds, right? That's what happens if you have a patch of land. And yeah, there might be a cool little tree or flower that tries to fight with the weeds there too and manages to survive. But you know, most of us know that that's not going to create the garden that you're hoping to have. So I'm not derogating or undermining the promise of psychedelics. I just think there's a tendency to latch on and be like, that's going to fix things for me, whereas it's only part of the solution, right? Stripping off a leaky set of shingles on your roof, very good first step if your roof is leaking. Not great long term if you want to have a nice secure home. You need to do more than just strip off the shingles. And I've seen no evidence that you're putting new shingles on with psychedelics, just that you're getting really good at it's going to help accelerate the stripping off process.
such a great analogy. I love that.
Oh, yeah,
Do you have
garden
time for?
shingles. I could do maybe one more, but I'm quite late for something else now. Yeah, so maybe one more.
Do you want to take off?
Let's do one more and then we'll go. I've already quickly apologized by email,
Oh,
but.
okay. We have one about sensory foraging, and I think you'll be able to kind of address this quickly, and whether or not it has parallel outcomes for people with chronic pain, or do you need a different approach? And I think, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, no, same approach. The trick is to make sure you're not just foraging into your pain all the time. Like if you're always foraging for like, is the pain there? That's part of the pathology in chronic pain is a preoccupation with the presence or absence of the pain, which leads to a worry about what would happen if you discovered it. So the idea that you want to do you like weaken that pattern by allowing yourself to also have moments where you're foraging out into other types of experiences, or even in the presence of pain, that there are other experiences available, even though pain is a dominant attractor signal, is a big part of it. The problem in chronic pain for most people is not the 1 out of 10 level of pain, though at high levels, you know, pain is ego obliterating. It's that many much of the other time it's not like an 8 or a 9 or a 10, but the fear about it prevents you from doing any of the other things that would give you connection or meaning in life. And of course, you're playing a much harder game than someone who doesn't have pain, right? So it's going to need again the support. But the idea that you don't want to let your habits become completely determined around the pain, and you're going to need some kind of practice to prevent that from happening, because that's what normally happens, because pain is designed to capture our attention and what we attend to becomes our habits. That's the same model, right? It's just that it's a visceral, a sensory pain as opposed to, but you're not going to get away from it by getting into your thoughts, right? You need to compete with pain with other types of sensory events. And unless the pain is super extreme, those sensory events are also available while pain is present. And that's like a magic thing for people with chronic pain to be like, you know, I'm someone who suffers from headaches. It's raining today. I knew it was going to rain today because I woke up at 1 a.m. with like a really bad headache this morning. And then it's just like, okay, so is that it? Or like, what else is available? Right. And so, yeah, you gotta find ways to work with where you are and support, which can include medication and definitely can include having other people who help you structure where you're moving your mind and your attention. Having those practices, I think, is still part of that model. It's the what does this pain mean for me that determines function in all but the most extreme cases, I would say.
Profound and helpful that you can actually have other sensory experiences alongside the experience of pain. I think that's really a cool concept to kind of ground into.
Yeah, hard to do when you want to avoid the pain, which would be like turning down the volume on all experience. But arguably, again, it's the long-term consequence of turning it down versus finding a way to stay open even though it hurts. Right. So it's a good point to kind of to sum up on it. That's the exploration. That's the game we're all playing, regardless of whether it's a pain condition or an emotional thing or social stress or whatever it is. How do we stay open even though it hurts sometimes?
Norm, thank you so much for being with us and for kind of bringing your whole heart and being and presence to this. I think it's really helpful and generative for people. You're getting lots of hearts floating through. I hope you can
Oh, that's nice. Thank
see
you.
and receive those. And for those of you that are here, please let us know if this is like helpful to you. I would love to do more of these now that I'm kind of coming out of the writing cave, and now that times are like really difficult. But it's just amazing to be able to be with you in this setting, Norm. And thank you for the book and the effort behind it and just the richness of it. I feel like it's one that I will come back to again and again. And I hope it's helpful to all of you as well. So
Yeah, thanks so
thank
much for having
you.
me, and thank you all for your attention. We went for like 100 minutes, so that's amazing. But I really do have to run, so thank you so much
Okay.
for having me. And well, maybe we could debrief a bit later, but I hopefully it was
All right.
helpful for you all.
Thank you,
Okay, take care,
Norm.
everyone.
We'll
Okay,
see
bye.
you. Thank you, everyone.